Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 16th of January. Hillary Clinton has recently said she would scrap No Child Left Behind. John Edwards would like to create college for everyone and has a plan to pay 1 year of public college tuition fees and books for more than 2 million students. Mike Huckabee says the music and the arts are not extraneous extracurricular or expendable and wants to provide every child these weapons of mass instruction. Barack Obama would like to support and reward successful teachers. And in last night's debate, he talked about providing some thousands of dollars for students to go to college. In return, they would do some kind of service. It could be military service or other service once they graduate from college. Ron Paul has a commitment to ensuring homeschooling and returning control of education to parents. Mitt Romney would like to make teaching a true profession. And Fred Thompson would like to promote voucher programs and charter schools. John McCain supporting unrestricted block grants and is against federally imposed standards with funding strings. And how about this idea? Many of you will say this is a good idea. Dennis Kucinich would like to provide universal education to all Americans from preschool through college and pay for these by, as he says, eliminating waste from our bloated, inefficient military budget. We're going to be looking at presidential candidate stands on education issues this hour of our program. Everybody always says it's one of the most important issues in the country, so let's spend some time dissecting their stands this first hour of our program this Wednesday. We have two guests with us. Professor David Menifee Leiby is a professor of politics and coordinator of the program in public policy analysis at Panoma College. Professor Menifee Leiby, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
And also joining us is Professor Kenneth Wong, Annenberg Chair for Education Policy, Professor of Education and Political Science, and also Public Policy Director of the Urban Education Policy Program at Brown University. Professor Wong, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, good to have both of you. Let's talk about pay for teachers. A number of the Democratic candidates have talked about attracting and supporting outstanding teachers and principals and pay them like the professionals they are. Two questions here. Would you agree that teachers need to make more money? And I guess the second part of the question is whether or not a president can make that happen. Who wants to start? Professor Wong, you want to start?
I think pay for performance is now getting national attention. And the federal government has set up a national research center to study that whole issue of how do you design a system and then track the performance of the teacher so that it is creating a reasonable base for assessing their performance. Now, it is a very controversial issue because up to this point, teachers are paid according to a fixed pay scale, and that is based on their years of education, credential, as well as the extent to which the teachers union and the management come to agreement on the pay scale step by step. So it's almost like an automatic pay scale process. Without having to look at whether the teachers are doing an effective job or a less than effective job. Now, so this whole notion has been getting a lot of attention among the nation's governors. And the National Governors Association, for example, recently organized a couple of conferences, and some governors are actually pushing ahead with that. So the interesting thing is that what can the new president do about this initiative? I think this is very much a state issue. It's a state-by-state issue. It's really depending on the context of the state and whether the governor and the legislature can come to an agreement in terms of both their own political issues, for example, working with the teachers' union in their own particular state, and also whether they are able to come into agreement to resolve some of the most tough technical issues, and that is how do you assess performance when education is a cumulative process? That is, if I am a 10th grade teacher, when I get my students into my 10th grade classroom, they've already gone through 11 years of education prior to coming to my classroom. So the question is that how do you assign the relative weight and responsibility of that teachers in educating the students coming to the classroom. So there are some tough technical issues. But I think the political wind seems to be moving more and more towards some kind of a performance-based assessment for teaching.
And Professor Wong, before we go to Professor Menefee Libby on this, do you think on the whole teachers are underpaid?
I think they are underpaid. And particularly if you take into consideration the work conditions that they are moving into. So in other words, I agree with some of the presidential candidates when they start talking about some kind of differential pay based on the challenge of the instructional setting. So if they are asked to teach in schools with very high concentrated poverty, or in some districts now they are talking about turnaround schools, and if they are asked to teach in those situations where the schools have been failing for 5, 6, or even 10 years, sometimes labeled as corrective actions to schools, and they've been failing for quite some time, and it's a disinvestment for a long time. So we really need to bring the most talented and the most creative and dedicated teachers to those schools. And one way to do that, I believe, is to create some incentives. Now, money may not be the only incentive, but I think if you look at it, so I would like to broaden that. It's not just dollars that we are talking about. It's also the overall work conditions. So you can actually think about a package of incentives to attract teachers to teach in those challenging environments.
Professor Menefee Libby, how do we attract those teachers? How do we attract just the best? And how do we compensate them? And can a president have influence over that?
Well, going from the last question you asked first, the question about presidential influence is one that's very attenuated between the national level and the local level. As Ken says, virtually all of these decisions are made at the level of states and school districts.
Mm-hmm.
And the president has a bully pulpit to talk about these things and to encourage states to take different approaches to this. But for the most part, the president can't leverage this much. The approach currently is to try to define what consists of a highly qualified teacher under No Child Left Behind and trying to encourage there to be a highly qualified or credentialed teacher in every classroom. But to take your other question about drawing in teachers and what kinds of incentives can be created, there are plenty of teachers in the United States, and there are plenty of trained and credentialed teachers in the United States. The challenge that we face is trying to keep them in classrooms. I mean, there are plenty of people who enter the profession briefly and decide that for one reason or another it isn't for them,
right,
and they attrit very quickly within the first 5 years at very high levels of attrition with teachers. So the challenge in part is to draw people into the profession but also to retain them. And then the question of allocation of how to get them into the schools where they are most needed is one that's been worked on now for decades, and trying to create incentives, as Professor Wong says, with pay and with working conditions, is the set of options in front of us, given that we have a market economy, trying to create incentives that will draw teachers in and help them stay in those jobs.
Let's talk about getting rid of bad teachers, and it's something that you hear often. I'm not sure how many bad teachers there are, but in his policy paper, Mike Huckabee talks about the fact that he took on the teachers union and got the fair dismissal law passed, which allowed that state to terminate incompetent teachers. What do you think about that, Professor Wong?
Right now, because of No Child Left Behind, it creates a kind of a policy framework for states to actually take more active action to deal with what you call incompetent teachers. And the interesting thing is that there are some states that are less regulatory in terms of protecting the teacher's job and teacher's tenure, what we call the collective bargaining states. And then there are some states that are weaker in terms of their collective bargaining culture. And I think most of the states in the southern part of the country are less regulatory in terms of the collective bargaining framework. So, in other words, governors in, say, Florida or Arkansas, Alabama, Mississippi, and so on, they usually can actually exercise a little bit more flexibility in terms of pushing through some of the legislation in terms of dismissing incompetent teachers. But at the same time, The No Child Left Behind now create a set of what they call corrective action options for states to think about if a school persistently fail for 3 for 4 years, then the state actually can identify that school, label that school as under some kind of a receivership or academic bankruptcy or some label like that. And then within that, once it's identified, then the staffing arrangement can be reallocated. And so it creates flexibility to lay off and let go some of the teachers, or all the teachers in those low-performing schools would have to reapply for the jobs. And so it does, across the country, there are school by school, and there are cluster of schools that are labeled that way that give the state and the district more flexibility to replace those teachers. Now, the question is that can they, and get back to David's comment earlier, once you replace, once you fire or dismiss those teachers, can you have a strong pool of teachers to select from? That's really the next implementation question that I think a lot of the candidates would have to think about. That is, it's easy to say that, okay, I'm going to dismiss the incompetent teachers, and everybody would agree with that. But the next step is that how do we assure that there will be a strong pool of candidates out there that would be a good substitute for the current incumbents?
Yeah. Let's talk about this idea. Dennis Kucinich has proposed universal education to all Americans from preschool through college. He proposes to pay for this by eliminating waste from our bloated, inefficient military budget and shifting the tax burden to those who can most afford it. And I'm wondering, you know, there are some countries that do provide this. Is this a goal that we should all be working toward, Professor Menefee-Leiby?
Well, you're talking to somebody who's a college professor, so I mean,
it's a good idea.
Exactly, that you would want all my students to be able to come here for free.
Sure.
I mean, it has a face appeal, right? That you look at it and see that you'd create greater access to education. But I mean, behind that, the reason that most European countries have embraced universal free education through higher education is with a investment vision in the longer term, that they view it as something that helps their society and their economy develop over the longer term, and they view it on balance as an investment that's been worthwhile for them. I mean, in the United States, had systems of higher education well established before it cost very much, and there was a mixture of public and private educational systems in ways that don't exist in European countries. I mean, colleges like my own, Pomona College in Southern California, there mm-hmm. isn't an analogy for that. In Europe, mm-hmm. The education system in Europe is almost entirely a public system. Understandably, there is an appeal for it to make it free, but it's also one of these things of how would you pay for it. And I think the broad agreement of the American public is that the most important level of education to assure access to and quality for is K-12 education, elementary and secondary education, to make sure that we have a universally educated and numerate and literate public that understands its citizenship obligations and is capable of self-government.
Both John Edwards and Barack Obama have proposed programs to pay for at least a year of public college tuition. That's Edwards' plan, fees and books for more than 2 million students. Students would be, and he brought this up last night, would be required to work part-time in college. Barack Obama talked about providing money for college, not all 4 years, but some thousands of dollars, and then community service work after you graduate from college. What do you think of that idea, those ideas, Professor Wong?
These are very interesting ideas from my perspective, and I think it's related to your previous question. And right now, the challenge is that a lot of the states have compulsory attendance law, compulsory education law, and they usually stop at the age 16. And so from age 16 onward, which means that the last couple of years of high school, the students are free to, you know, take up part-time jobs. And so we do have a big gap right there after age 16. So the question that the proposals of the two candidates, I would suggest, would have to also link to this problem between 16 and 18 gap. That is, prior to their preparation to go to college. There are these 2 years that are missing in our compulsory education attendance law. Then we need to fix that. And then we need to link it then to Edwards and Obama's proposal, and that is once they graduate from high schools and make sure that almost all our students would be able to stay in school through age 18, 17, 18, and then we can then move on to their proposal to think about the best way to support the students who go to college. Now, the question here is we do have a lot of choices, as David was suggesting. In the European context, they are mainly kind of public domain, they're public-oriented institutions. And here we have a lot of, among higher education, we do see a lot of stratification here, and choice and stratification goes together. And so what we need to do is to enable the students to not only get access to college, but also would also match, hopefully, create a system whereby we could create a foundation for them to better match their interests and talents so that they would also have equal access to some of the more expensive institutions.
Yes. Would you agree that we need to look more seriously at this compulsory education extending to 17 and 8-year-olds, Professor Menefee-Leiby?
Well, that's an important question, and the thing that Ken is raising there is something that there is innovation at the state level. At this period between 16 and 18 or 16 and 20, a number of states are looking at what they call K through 14 policies that are looking at that first year or two of education post high school. And there are some states like Minnesota which have begun to blur the boundaries between high school and higher education so that if you've completed coursework in Minnesota, for example, through a certain set of required courses in high school and you have good grades and you have a clear plan, you can enroll in a local community college and begin to take courses there. And so there isn't the same kind of hard boundary between high school and college that does sort of close off access in some ways. And then the question that Ken is raising about sort of opportunity and choice I think is tremendously important, where you want to have a broader view of higher education that is not that is focused on work preparation as well as specific occupational courses, as well as liberal arts education. So the full range of possibilities is there for a 15, 16, 17-year-old that they can begin to see what's appropriate for their lives. And I think that that's the central concern for candidates like Edwards and Obama is to have that not tied to the income of the family of that child, that they have it be more in line with what their preferences are and what their abilities and interests are.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. We're looking at where the candidates stand on education issues this hour of our program. Professor David Menefee-Leiby is a professor of politics and coordinator of the program in public policy analysis at Panoma College in California. Professor Kenneth Wong is Annenberg Chair for Education Policy, a professor of education, political science, and public policy director of the Urban Education Policy Program at Brown University. We welcome your phone calls. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And we have this email you can use as well, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll speak with the author of Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. Richard Longworth will join us. It's a really good book. He's got in his car and drove 11,000 miles all over the Midwest and looked at the things that the Midwest used to do very well, which was farming and manufacturing, and those have changed substantially in the last 10 years, how the Midwest is coping. Some cities have been able to switch direction and keep the level of unemployment from going too high. Other cities have been just terrifically hard hit, as have some rural areas. What's the answer? How has globalization affected the Midwest? And it's going to be an important and really good conversation, I think. So stay with us. presidential candidate's stance on education. This hour, our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And we start our phone calls with Gail from Ephraim. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was listening to this program, and I remember more than 20 years ago an interview done by Mr. Richard Feynman, the quantum physicist, and they were discussing the educational system and how it really needed to be revamped at that time, and that was over 20 years ago. And he was stating that the problem with the programs that are going on aren't really addressing the educational system at all in enhancing children to be thinking differently in order to solve the problems that we will have in the future, which we're having now, because they needed to change the system so that they were teaching elementary physics first before any type of mathematical program, teaching them any type of math, anything to do with numbers, because they needed that elementary concept to be able to assimilate everything and actually be thinking differently in a more advanced way than every other program they would give them through all of the years of their education. They would become more powerful in their education and be able to handle things in the world now. That has not happened, and we're seeing the results now, and everybody is scrambling, I think, focusing on the wrong information. They need to go back and change the curriculum to actually help these kids
right.
get educated in a better way.
All right, let's give that to you. Professor Wong.
I remember I was listening to a lecture by the Nobel physicist Leon Lederman, and he was also talking about physics first in the high school curriculum. And in fact, because of the work of Leon Lederman and other people in among the physicists, they are able to actually start this movement in the last few, 10, 15 years now. And so there are an increasing number of high schools and districts that are now reversing the way they teach the sciences. So they will start off with physics, as you mentioned, Gail, that they will start off with physics because they see that as kind of a foundational mathematical application process, more inquiry-based teaching. And so the challenge here is the resistance on the part of the school themselves and the way they set up the structure. So the science department still look at it that, okay, physics, we can wait until the 11th grade or 12th grade, and then let's do biology first and then chemistry and so on. So there is still a mindset that needs to be changed. Now, I actually welcome these competition. These are two models, right? One is the existing one that start with biology and then end with physics. The other is to start with physics first and then end it with the other subject. And I think we need to have some kind, we need to continue to allow some kind of innovation across different districts. After all, we've got 15,000 school districts. And the important challenge here is that once we start off with these kind of new initiatives, we need to map out and assess and evaluate whether they are, how they are working, whether they are working, under what conditions they are working. And we don't have enough evidence now to really track whether the students are learning more in terms of problem-solving skills under the new initiative. And I would like to see more of these kind of studies and so that we know for sure whether we are making a good investment or not.
Professor Menifee-Libby, let's go to voucher schools, charter schools for a moment. A number of the Republican candidates have talked about promoting voucher programs, Fred Thompson and charter schools, John McCain supporting unrestricted block grants and supporting school choice, tax-funded vouchers, local charter schools, Mitt Romney focus on math and science, which is what we were just talking about, Ron Paul, who has a lot of information on ensuring homeschooling, returning control of education to parents. Do you think that it behooves the Republicans to center on these kinds of programs rather than education at large, because even though there's a lot of interest in voucher programs and charter schools, most of the students in this country go to public schools?
Well, two things. One is the thing that you telegraphed in the last sentence that you had there, which is that these are ideas that are coming principally out of the Republican side of the presidential campaign. We're not hearing a lot of emphasis from Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or John Edwards about choice and vouchers,
right,
and things like that. But the second thing is to draw the distinction between a voucher approach to schooling and a charter school approach to schooling. And the idea in vouchers is to open it up so that taxpayer dollars can go to public schools or can go to private schools and a variety of schools. I mean, Milwaukee has done the recent experiment on that, and there's some experience with it there, so that people will know the distinction. But I think nationally, most Americans don't know that charter schools are public schools that are simply governed in a different way and sometimes take a somewhat different form. And that distinction is an important one for most people. And the attempts to try to be creative at the level of school within a charter school is done under the boundaries of the sort of the state education system. And there is a tremendous amount of innovation happening more in the charter school sector than in the voucher school sector, because there are so few voucher experiments around the country. What I'm finding, though, that surprises me is that when I look at charter schools, for the most part, there is not a lot of innovation happening there in the area of what Gail was talking about and what Ken was just talking about, which is about how education is done at the level of instruction of children and what the culture of a school is and what the sort of educational focus of a school is. For the most part, charter schools are very conventional schools and very traditional schools in terms of what they teach and how they teach. And so we're seeing a lot of innovation at the level of who's running the school and who's teaching the schools. We're not seeing a lot of innovation at the level of instruction.
Yes. Let's go to John next from Junction City. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you? Thanks for making it possible for me to contribute.
Sure.
I think this is a great discussion to be having, and I appreciate the fact that we're doing that. I'm horrified by the idea of firing incompetent teachers and shutting down schools that don't meet the standards of a program like No Child Left Behind. How do you define what makes someone incompetent, and how do you define what makes a school a good school or a bad school? There are so many factors that are involved. And in fact, an incompetent teacher should be getting help, not being just necessarily summarily dismissed. So I'm suggesting that what we need, in fact, is more investment in education. We've been going the opposite way with cutting funding and shutting down school districts. And I think that, to me, almost seems to be sort of a shadow idea behind this No Child Left Behind, is how do you continue to keep taking funding away from education, of which there is nothing more important. And I'll get off on that because I'm on my track phone and expending a lot of minutes, so I'll listen
okay,
to this.
Okay, John, session. Thanks
Thank
so much
you.
For the call. Professor Wong?
Yeah, I think I agree with John that there needs to be a balance between sanctions and support. So right now we have a lot of sanctions under No Child Left Behind, a lot of labeling, a lot of categorizing. But I have to say that the sanctions actually primarily are basically defined by the state. So the state come up with their own standards of defining what would be adequate yearly progress. It's a state-by-state decision. But having said that, then I think we need to look at the support side. That is, having sanctions is one thing, but at the same time, we also need to be thinking about what kind of support. Can we develop certain targeted strategies? Now, the question is, these are very tough decisions to be made by the school leaders at the district as well as the school level. And that is, if you have fixed dollar amount, if you have fixed number of FTE, then how are you going to allocate them? Would you want to continue to support those teachers that are considered as less than effective based on the number of students who fail and so on? Or do you want to explore other strategies and bring in other teachers who are going to be able to do a better job? So these are trade-offs. These are tough allocative decisions that have to be made. Now, so what I am seeing across the country is the talk about professional development. So there are more and more schools now that are actually making use of the summer prior to the start of a new school year. So they will front-load the system with 5 weeks or 2 weeks of intensive professional development and getting the teachers to learn how to use data to adjust the instruction, teaching the teachers how to use the latest teaching literacy strategies and differentiated instruction and things like that, so that they will be prepared to do a better job. So that I'm seeing as a very productive and promising way to deal with this question of incompetent teacher.
Mm-hmm. Just a few more words on No Child Left Behind, Professor Menifee Leiby. Her early campaign literature showed that Senator Clinton wanted to reform No Child Left Behind. I've heard her on the stump in New Hampshire and in Iowa saying that it's time for No Child Left Behind to go, and it always, those words are received with thunderous applause from teachers particularly. There's not a love for this program, I don't think, among teachers. And she changed her position perhaps and went farther than reform, maybe because teachers are not very happy with it. What do you think?
Well, it's a funny coalition that opposes No Child Left Behind and is very critical of it. That on the one hand, as you say, there are teachers who are very skeptical of it, ranging from skeptical of it to hostile toward it, and that there are also local governments and state governments in blue and red states around the country, including conservatives and including Republican states, that are opposing to it because of the degree of federal intrusion in the state control of schools. And so some of the first and most aggressive opposition to No Child Left Behind came from states like Utah that wanted to opt out of the system entirely because they viewed it as a federal infringement. So there's not – one of the things that's happened since the law was enacted in 2002 is that it's lost its broad support coalition, so that there's not a lot of people out there who are going to stand up for the law and try to defend it and make it be sustained through the next few years as we're reenacting it. And that's been the struggle within Congress as they've been trying to amend it, is trying to figure out who the coalition is that would support it and vote for it now that there's been this kind of emptying out by teachers on the Democratic side and by local governments and people that are concerned with local control on the conservative side.
Let's go next to John from Barnes. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
It's a wonderful discussion. I really enjoy these gentlemen and the good remarks that they have. In fact, while I was waiting to come on the air and listening to the comments, I was really surprised to find the discussion of physics first, and that's not why I called.
Right.
But I happen to have been one of the authors of a program called Active Physics that was
supported. Oh, really?
Yeah, supported by the National Science Foundation and through the American Institute of Physics, which I had been involved with quite a bit.
Hmm.
But, you know, I'm a teacher at the root of things, and I did want to comment that we had foreseen need to have kids involved in physics much earlier, and we have the only existing curriculum, so far as I know, that's published and available to schools and been adopted some places around the country that addresses that. And Leon Letterman is well aware of it, and we've, in fact, collaborated with him somewhat on it.
Hmm.
So on to what I really wanted to...
Send us more information, John. We'd be interested in what you're doing.
Okay. Actually, I'm a retired teacher now. I was a physics teacher, a curriculum supervisor, and I had a very rich career. I had opportunity to be involved, especially at the federal level, with educational research. And that's what I really wanted to address. And some of my experience, I interacted with a gentleman by the name of Philip Schlechte. I know maybe one of your guests will know about him, who did quite a bit of research, well, probably 20 years ago, on teaching as a career. And at that time, I was, of course, very fascinated with his work because I was kind of in the middle of my career. And one thing that stuck with me that he came up with was this. If you obtain your college degree, if you choose to teach, you get paid X. And if you do anything else with that degree, you get paid 2X. So there is that disparity. And if we wonder why we have trouble recruiting and retaining teachers, that's just a reality that we need to consider.
Sure.
And as a result of that, Schlechte did identify, and lots of other people picked this up, what was called a career ladder for teachers, wherein, and this is consistent with some of the comments your guests made, too, some teachers may choose to be really fully professional teachers instead of just journeymen, so to speak. Whereas a journeyman might just say, I just prefer to teach during the school year, that's it. Others may wish to be involved in curriculum development, in professional development, and even extend their work throughout the school year, through the summer, get involved with people at the university, you know, with the preparation of teachers and the like. And you can certainly differentiate the pay easily in that regard. So, you know, I think those are things that I'd like to hear your guests
sure.
talk about a little bit. And finally, I think the research pretty clearly shows there's a major study involving outcomes of the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is kind of the gold standard for data in student outcomes, which clearly demonstrates that poverty is at the root of the lacking performance in our inner city schools, often with minority kids. And if we don't level the playing field in regard to the kinds of resources, the quality of teachers, and so on that we have in all of our schools, we do not have an educational system in the United States for which we can say the quality of one's education is not a function of where you happen to live. It is a function of where you happen to live. And I'll just take the comments
Fine, John.
Off the air.
And send us information on physics, okay?
We'll do that.
Thank
sure.
you. Thank you. We'd like to hear from you. That was a great call. Professor Menifee-Leibe brought up a lot of areas.
Oh,
take
boy.
Your pick.
Yeah. One of the central things that John is raising there is that you can't improve education without teachers. And for the most part, given the supply of teachers that we have out there, we're going to need to do this work with the teachers who are currently in the classroom or about to enter the classroom. And that's just a pragmatic fact, regardless of how much we like teachers or don't like teachers or are teachers or aren't teachers. The fact is that the teachers who are in the schools right now are going to be the ones who carry out any reform that we want to carry out. And one of the challenges that we face is that often the best teachers who are there are lured to other opportunities that they have
sure.
and other careers. And it's kind of funny that when we think about education and teaching, all of a sudden all of our understanding about markets and market logic goes out the window. We don't want to talk so much about creating incentives to keep people in there and creating broader incentives in the pool to lure people into the profession. But there's been a recent study just published about teachers and the comparison of their pay at their education level with other people with similar levels of education and professional responsibility. And John is right. I mean, if you're a K through 12 teacher, especially in the public sector, but even in the private sector, you're not making as much money as you could be doing something else. So that you must be there because you're drawn to teaching as a profession. And I think that often we as citizens try to take advantage of that and hope that the teachers will just look the other way when we don't pay them the same way we pay other professionals.
Exactly. More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about where the candidates stand, Democratic and Republican, on education issues. And there are lots of issues that we've been touching on here. Our guests are Professor David Menifee-Leibe. He's a professor of politics and coordinator of the program in public policy analysis at Pomona College in California. Professor Kenneth Wong is Annenberg Chair for Education Policy, a professor of education political science, and public policy director of the Urban Education Policy Program at Brown University. We have one line open if you'd like to join our conversation, and all our email message slots are open if you'd like to send an email. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, a very important book, Caught in the Middle, America's Heartland in the Age of Globalism. Richard Longworth will be our guest. He spent 11,000 miles traveling through the Midwest, through the heartland of the country, looking at what's happened to the two things that the Midwest has done for a living for a number of years, farming and heavy industry. Both have changed quite radically. Some towns have been able to adjust, and some have not. The book, he says, is a report from the front line of America's new economy. He'll be with us after 10. And I hope you will, too. It should be a good discussion. All right, back to education issues, 800-486-8655. Kate from New Berlin is our next caller. Hi, Kate.
Good morning. I had a couple of comments, actually. There's some talk of what people do for a living and what the rewards are. A lot of studies in terms of job satisfaction in the long run don't lead to money. What tends to create happiness in people in their jobs is control over their situation, and more and more and more, as teachers have become the political whipping boy for the education problems in this country, there is less and less of that available for teachers. At one point last year, second semester, I was in a special ed classroom with students who were between 3 and 4 years behind in reading. And during the course of the semester, I probably spent 4 weeks combined in doing standardized testing with them, which meant that, you know, they didn't need that. They needed more work on what they were behind in. So that's one of the issues. And the other issues that I see that in terms of fixing the education system, we got to stop starting at schools. The real problem is the 5 girls I have who are currently in foster care, the one that's a runaway, what's the problem is that a lot of the kids within the inner city come from a broken culture, and we need to figure out how to help some of those cultures rebuild.
Thank you, Kate, for your call. Your phone is cutting in and out here. Professor Wong, let's go to you on that.
I think that also gets back to John's earlier comment about poverty. And I think too often we look at education as the solution to poverty. And I agree with Kate that we need to think of education as an anchor in the context of a neighborhood, in a context of a social service system. And so it is very important for educational sector to collaborate with other sector to really attack this problem of poverty. And I think it's too big a problem for teachers and principals alone to deal with poverty. And so that, of course, have implications on family policy and quality of life in urban communities. And I think that's where some of the mayors are now moving into to really be a part of that whole strategic conversation. The other question that you raised, Kate, I think is very important, and that is the degree to which the profession themselves think about their degree of control. And that's why I'm seeing, coming back to this notion of charter school, and I think that's the attractiveness of charter school to a lot of the public school teachers and principals. And a lot of charter schools are actually created by former public school teacher and principal. Former public, meaning that all of these are public, and I agree with David, they are publicly funded, but except that charter school exercise a lot more autonomy in terms of designing their curriculum, use of time, their staffing pattern, and so on. So I think the system is large enough that I would anticipate that there will be more site-based experiment, more degree of collective collaboration in terms of solving some of these instructional problems, rather than continue on with a top-down kind of a bureaucratic arrangement.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the call. Before we go back to phone calls, let's talk for a few moments about student loans. Senator John Edwards making the point that the banks that make loans receive large federal subsidies and also a guarantee against default, even though the U.S. Department of Education offers the same loans that are far less expensive for taxpayers. He believes that students should be able to borrow directly from the Department of Education. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's not something that I've spent any time doing research on. I mean, I'm probably in the same place that you are and reading in the papers. The challenge that we faced last year was the investigations that showed that there were kickback relationships happening between lenders and lending officers within colleges. And so there are perverse incentives within the system to the extent that schools can steer people toward profit based lenders, and we don't want to have decisions about higher education and access to higher education for young people being made on the basis of the largest profit that can be gained by a lender. You'd rather have those decisions being made on the basis of what kinds of education we want for those young people as a country.
Let's go next to Bud from Sturgeon Bay. Hello, Bud.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you for the nice conversation you and your guests are having. See, the question I have is, as a taxpayer, I certainly don't begrudge the publicly funded aspect of education. The problem I have is how much of those funds that I pay in taxes actually go to the education of the students. I wonder if maybe health care impacts education at all levels, you know, from the administration, the health care packages that the administrators get to the teachers' packages, and how much is avoidance of and the use of attorneys being spent by the school districts to in litigation that has prompted them. It just seems to me that our society has a bunch of built-in costs here that nobody's discussing. I'll take my answer offline, Kathy. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, Bud, for the call. Professor Wong.
Yes, I think there are now, this is a big question among a lot of the state legislature and governors, and so they are asking the district to demonstrate exactly what percentage of the dollars actually go, or resources go into classroom. And so Texas, for example, passed a law a year and a half ago, required that at least 65% of the resources would go into the instructional classroom services. And so now, and that gets to the other 35%. Now, granted that we do have to deal with escalating health costs, litigation fees, as your caller suggested, but in addition, there are other support services that are necessary to support student learning. For example, counseling, librarian, bus drivers, and so on and so forth. So you've got a whole bunch of infrastructural necessity that are kind of sitting on top of the classroom, and I think we need to revisit that and then see if we can continue to allocate the resources in the most efficient way, particularly allocating in a way that would target on the children who would need the resources most.
And thank you so much for the call. Let's go to David next from Thorpe. Hi, David.
Good morning. Thank you for the program today, and thanks for the insights of your guests. My observation is that we've got a political season right now with a number of candidates talking about a diverse grouping of opinions on which direction the educational process should go. Each of them also talks about how they want to change and reach across the aisle and reach out for other opinions. I'm wondering if your guests would be able to elaborate on what they would view bits and pieces from each of the candidates' programs as a optimum educational program.
Professor Menifee Leiby.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, one of the striking things about this year is the contrast with the last two times that we chose a new president. I mean, George W. Bush in 2000 and Bill Clinton back in 1992. And in both of those cases, we had fairly experienced governors who had been involved with reforming their own state school systems. And both of them talked extensively during their campaigns about what they wanted to do with education at the national level. President Clinton talked a lot about standards and improving teaching, and President Bush talked a lot about the achievement gap, particularly between poor children and non-poor children or children of color and others, and trying to use assessment as a tool for bringing about improvement. And so Clinton and Bush both had really big ideas that they wanted to bring in, and those ideas reached across the aisle. I mean, one of the things that's striking about this year is that there are a couple of governors in there. I mean, we do have Romney and Huckabee, but there isn't anyone coming to the table with the same kind of big idea about how to transform the system, especially nobody with a really big idea that reaches across the aisle in the same way that Clinton and Bush did in 92 and 2000. So, I mean, I have to confess to David that I don't see a lot. I do see a lot of variation in the small details that these candidates are talking about and the general thrust, but I don't see a recipe that I can draw out of the mixture that would come together into some kind of a broad strategy for improvement.
Professor Wong, we have about a minute left.
Yeah, it seems that most of the candidates are running against either for or against NCLB, so No Child Left Behind.
Right.
So in other words, the NCLB has already set the agenda for all the candidates. And I agree with David that they don't quite go outside of that box. The question is that maybe they do not want to go outside of that box because they might want to appeal to the broadest constituency. And so they would probably keep the accountability framework. They would probably keep some kind of teacher qualification framework. But at the same time, they're basically, making some adjustment to the NCLB framework.
Thank you both so much for being with us. What a great conversation, and I wish we could just go for hours with it. We'll have you back as the campaign progresses, and we took on so much today. Maybe we can center on the Republicans one show and the Democrats on another show. But thank you for your expertise and willingness to be with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thanks a lot, Kathleen.
Yeah, thank you. Our guest, Professor Kenneth Wong. He is Annenberg Chair for Education Policy, also a Professor of Education and Political Science, and Public Policy Director of the Urban Education Policy Program at Brown University. Professor David Menefee-Leiby is a Professor of Politics and Coordinator of the Program in Public Policy Analysis at Pomona College in California. Thanks to both of them for being with us, and to Rhonda Fanning for producing this very interesting hour. To all of your great calls, you're so good, you're so informed, you're a great audience. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and I don't often urge you to listen to the next show, but I feel so strongly about what this guest has done looking at what's happened to the Middle West that I urge you to listen to him. It's going to be a good hour. That's coming up following the news.